From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The issue of voting rights comes up for a test vote in the Senate tomorrow. Democrats are proposing a sweeping bill to counter restrictions passed by Republican-led state legislatures. But not a single Republican senator is expected to vote yes on this congressional action, which is why some voting rights activists are praising a compromise plan proposed by Democrat Joe Manchin, who up until now has been the Democratic Party's sole holdout on the issue. But not everyone is into Manchin's proposal. Joining us now is Kat Calvin, founder of the voting rights group Spread the Vote, which focuses on helping people get IDs in order to do things like vote. Hi, Kat.
Thanks.
There's a lot of support for Manchin's new narrower version of a federal voting and campaign finance overhaul. Voting rights activist Stacey Abrams says that she would absolutely support Manchin's compromise. She calls it a vital step. You feel otherwise. You specifically have problems with this new addition to Manchin's proposal requiring voter ID. Tell us more on why.
So, you know, voter ID laws started to grow and become really popular across this country after the Supreme Court gutted a big part of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. And we've seen in those few years, we've seen us go from about four states that had voter ID laws to we're at about 36 now. And it has been something that everyone in the voting rights world, everyone sort of on the lefter side of politics, even the moderate side of politics, has really been fighting for a long time because there are over 21 million eligible voters in this country who do not have photo ID and who cannot vote with these laws. It's so wildly difficult for people that it really does add up to really more than a poll tax. You know, my grandmother used to tell me about her parents saving change and then counting it up in the kitchen and then going to pay to vote. It's not that easy to get an ID. And so this is the thing we've been fighting now for almost 10 years. And, you know, Stacey Abrams didn't just say that she would support this. She and Warnock both actually said, well, nobody's ever objected to voter ID, which isn't true because even they objected to voter ID a few months ago. But we all object to voter ID. It keeps tens of millions of people from being able to vote. So it's...
Well, Kat, let's break this down a little bit. Can we break this down a little bit?
Of course.
Abrams' argument is that this bill puts forward some basic building blocks. It's the setting of uniform standards, like making Election Day a public holiday, banning partisan gerrymandering. Her contention on why she's supporting it is that those changes are progress over not getting anything passed. Do you understand where she's coming from?
You know, I don't, because the thing is, Democrats have the majority in the House, the Senate, and the White House. We actually could just pass a bill, right? Like, that's the thing is that, you know, they did this with the healthcare bill, where we had this incredible bill, and then they kept trying to get Republicans to support it. So they kept cutting it back and cutting it back and cutting it back. And they still ended up passing a bill without any Republican support. I understand where they're coming from, because pragmatism always wins over doing the right thing in the Democratic Party, but it's not something they have to do at all.
Republicans, of course, argue that requiring voters to show ID is common sense and it increases public confidence in the voting system. What would you like to see as an alternative specifically for requiring voter ID?
I mean, here's the thing. Like, we live in California, which is more people than anyone in the country, does not have voter ID laws, does not have a problem with public confidence in the elections, right? Like, they say that out loud. But first of all, we have nothing but studies that prove voter fraud doesn't exist. There isn't a problem with confidence in voting. And when it is, it's because you have a man who lost an election and then tried to spread a big lie. We also have tons of footage and quotes from them specifically saying, we need voter ID laws because we need people not to vote so we can win.
Right. We know we've been here before. Soon after Obama was elected president, we saw a huge surge of Republican-led legislatures passing laws requiring photo IDs. Your organization, Spread the Vote, though, helps people, as you said, obtain IDs for jobs and other things like that. What don't we understand about the challenges of getting an ID?
You need an ID to get a job. to get housing, to get food at most food banks, to get nights at most shelters, right? Ironically, to get COVID tests and vaccines in most places. There's a huge problem with foster kids who age out of the system at 18, and then they're just spit into the streets, and they're not given an ID or any of the documents that they need in order to get that ID. Our average ID cost is $40, but it costs a lot more than that for a lot of people. One of the things they say in this bill is, oh, well, you can just vote with a utility bill. Well, you don't have a utility bill if you don't have a home. And so what they're basically saying is if you're unhoused, you don't deserve to participate in democracy, right? Like, it is so hard. It takes us, we're the only national ID obtaining organization in the country. We are experts at this. It takes us an average of 3 to 4 weeks, and that was before COVID, to help someone get an ID. It's rough, you know?
Kat Calvin is founder of the voting rights group Spread the Vote. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we have an update now on a story we brought you earlier this month when we reported that the Biden administration had missed its own deadline to come up with a plan for former President Trump's unfinished border wall. After that story aired, the White House said it would divert billions of dollars slated for border wall construction to other projects. The administration also said some of the money will be used to clean up abandoned construction sites and fix damage to the environment. Miles Traphagen works along the border for the Wildlands Network. Miles, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you, Peter. Good to talk to you again.
You know, and when you and I last traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border a few weeks ago in Arizona, we saw unfinished construction sites. There were tractors and bulldozers parked in the desert, piles of unused steel stacked up, and, you know, even blasted mountaintops. What do you think? Does this latest announcement from the White House mean that all this is going to be cleaned up?
That's what we're hoping. And I have to say, I'm very optimistic, and this is really good news. And we've been waiting with bated breath for a long time to hear what was going to happen after the 60-day review, which actually began on January 20th when President Biden stopped the border wall construction.
So the Department of Homeland Security says it's going to be reviewing some of the environmental damage along the border. I know you've been doing that inventory for months now. Where would you tell them to start?
Well, we've identified about a dozen sites in Arizona, New Mexico. That's where I'm focusing. And as you saw when we went out in the field, a place called Cerro del Fresnal, basically the entire top of the mountain had been blasted through. And there are several other sites along the border in the two states where the same thing happened. And we're really concerned that if immediate mitigation and remediation and restoration does not occur, we could see a lot of cascading effects downstream after our summer monsoon rains come.
All right. Well, I want to play this from my conversation with Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva, who represents a border district down there in southern Arizona. This is from earlier this month.
You can't reconstruct a sacred site. You can't replace a mountaintop. You can't eliminate the effect on wildlife species and water depletion in the area. Those are hard to put back.
And I know that you agree, Miles, that some of that damage is irreparable. I'm thinking about that mountaintop that you described just blown off there. If that is the case, and not everything can be totally fixed, I mean, what are you hoping can get done? How much of the damage can be reversed?
Well, we're hoping that at least we can stop the bleeding, I guess I would say, because there are going to be situations where all of that debris following, you know, the heavy desert rains that we get, you know, the type where, you know, several inches can fall in just a few minutes. If that travels downstream, you could choke up existing water courses. Often flood events like this will cover up natural springs. And, you know, water is vital in the desert. So the wildlife could be severely impacted by future erosional events. And on top of this, there's also a public safety issue, is that there are places that are basically like unstabilized mine sites. And this constitutes a public hazard to people, vehicles, livestock. We're going to end up with recurring damage. And there's nothing worse than a snowball effect after you've already had a disaster like this.
Yeah, I mean, time is of the essence if you're talking about the monsoon rain season, because that is on its way in the southwestern United States. Do you think that the Biden administration has time to make these changes?
You know, I really wish that we did have time, and I appreciate their efforts, and I believe that the efforts by the administration and the Department of Homeland Security are sincere at this point, from our conversations that we've had with them, but we really are racing against time. You know, today, for example, our dew point is at 61, and the monsoon is triggered by a 54-degree dew point for 3 days in a row. So when I'm looking at these weather readings, which I check every day, it's starting to tell me that, you know, the rains are on the way and we better do something quick.
I want to ask you about something that Texas Governor Greg Abbott said last week. He says that state agencies and private landowners there in Texas are going to pick up wall construction where the former president, Donald Trump, left off. Of course, it's not really clear that he's going to be able to do that. These are federal projects. But what do you think about that as a concept? I mean, if nothing else, it does show that building that wall remains a pretty politically potent idea for conservatives.
Well, it pretty much is just their stake in the ground for, you know, a tribalistic approach to politics. It does not constitute a real policy solution. It's not addressing the root problems of immigration. I believe the states are really talking out of turn when they're trying to take matters into their own hands and take on a federal responsibility.
Miles Traphagen is Borderlands Program Coordinator for the Wildlands Network. Works along the U.S.-Mexico border in the southwestern United States. Miles, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
In Colorado over the weekend, Democratic Governor Jared Polis signed into law three pieces of gun legislation that will expand background checks for purchases and create an office solely aimed at gun violence prevention. This latest action out of Colorado is up against a wave of resolutions and laws throughout the country that defy federal gun laws. More than 400 counties in 20 states have signed what is called Second Amendment sanctuary legislation to counter perceived encroachments on gun rights. Missouri Governor Mike Parson is the latest Republican governor to sign this kind of legislation, and the governor has already gotten a stiff warning from the Department of Justice in the form of a letter warning that Missouri does not have the authority to throw out federal law. For more, let's bring in Anders Walker, constitutional law professor at St. Louis University. Anders, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So what exactly is in this Missouri law?
So this law is, at the moment, a bit of political theater. The law says that if the federal government tries to regulate arms, anyone who cooperates with the federal government locally could be fined, which is a little outrageous.
Mm. We should note that this Second Amendment sanctuary movement is using language that was made popular during the Trump presidency. Sanctuary cities have said they wouldn't assist the federal government's crackdown on undocumented immigration, for instance. Are so-called gun sanctuaries using that same legal precedent?
The difference here is that anyone who cooperates with the federal government in Missouri will be fined. If you remember the sanctuary cities for immigration, the threat there was that the president would cut funding to those cities. And so no one was going to fine anybody if they cooperated with the feds. But for the state to then penalize people who do follow federal law, that violates the Supremacy Clause.
Okay, so I'm going to use the example of legalizing marijuana. Even though it remains a controlled substance on a federal level, Missouri and other states say they just won't enforce federal gun laws. Can they get away with that?
They can only get away with that so long as the federal government does not require that they enforce federal law. Congress has created an exception for medical marijuana, but for recreational use, it is a very unstable situation, and the federal government could at any point move in, and the same holds true for guns.
Okay. Will all of this have any practical effect in Missouri? For instance, could we see more people purchase guns who shouldn't be able to?
Well, presently, it really has very little effect because the gun laws in Missouri are basically sympathetic to the federal gun laws. So the federal government controls automatic weapons, explosives, military-grade weapons. If anyone wants one of those, they have to actually register and gain permission from the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms.
I mean, the fact is nationwide gun control efforts have been stalled for decades. Why are states moving on this now?
Well, I think conservatives are on the back foot. I think they feel like they are soon to be a minority. And we're seeing them actively try to shore up gun rights, free exercise of religion, abortion. And I think there's some real concern now on the conservative side that the political winds are shifting against them. And they're going to have to double down, ironically, on civil rights as a political minority.
Right. Do you think that the Biden administration will make more moves to crack down on these gun sanctuaries?
I think Joe Biden so far has been very savvy in not pushing issues that are going to generate an explosive backlash. However, I think he has made it clear he does want to go after things like the AR-15, high-volume magazines. And if Missouri tries to say, oh, you can't regulate fully automatic weapons, then the federal government's going to show up and they're going to throw out the law. So I think the midterm elections are key. We'll probably see something happen after that. If the Democrats can increase their majority just a little bit, then they really are going to have quite a bit of momentum to affect some change, and I think maybe re-up the assault weapons ban.
What message does this bill send, even if it is almost purely symbolic?
Well, I personally think it sends a losing message, which is we're going to double down on opening up gun sales to everybody and anybody. I don't think it's a good look for the NRA. I don't think it's even a good look for gun owners. It just makes them look irresponsible. However, in the game of cultural politics, it is an issue that Republicans run on when they are actually relying more and more on working class white voters, especially in Missouri. Josh Hawley, Roy Blunt, don't have a lot of support among financial elites in this state. They're really doubling down on rural white voters, and they don't have much to offer them by way of jobs or education or opportunities. Ultimately, I don't think this is going to be a way forward for them.
That's Anders Walker, constitutional law professor at St. Louis University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Local music venues across the country struggled to stay afloat during the pandemic because of COVID restrictions. But when Massachusetts decided to lift all of those restrictions at the end of May, the businesses were sent scrambling to reopen on short notice. Amelia Mason from our home station WBUR headed to the Boston neighborhood of Jamaica Plain to find out how one club is adjusting to the new normal.
When Massachusetts shut down in March of 2020, Jay Balerna figured his bar, the Midway Cafe, would only be closed a few weeks. So he hired someone to give the club a facelift while it sat empty.
I'm like, put a coat of polyurethane on the bar every day until, because it was going to be 3 weeks. And then after 3 weeks, he's like, that's 20 coats. Should I keep going? I'm like, that's more than is on a boat, you know?
That bar is still as shiny as a brand new sailboat more than a year later. But Balerna can't wait to get it dirty now that he can open at full capacity.
It's such a relief. I'm psyched to just let people be people and hang out like we did before, you know.
The past year has been the hardest in Balerna's more than three decades running the Midway Cafe. Over the years, the beloved neighborhood rock club survived as other venues shuttered, felled by rising rents and thinning crowds. Then came the pandemic.
I've been running a live music place for 33 years, so I know how to keep booze on the shelf, keep the bands relatively happy, keep the employees relatively happy, keep the stealing to a minimum, and all of a sudden, take all that stuff that you know how to do, take that right off the table, you're going to learn how to fill out grants.
That's exactly what he did, scraping by with a patchwork of grants, loans, and unemployment. He even took out an equity line on his house. He's now in six figures of debt. As the bills mounted, Balerna started having panic attacks.
All of a sudden, I might feel like I'm going to throw up on the edge of tears. And then I got to go home to my three kids. And I got to be like, hey, what's everything is great, you know? They're like, can't be falling apart. So you just have these little private terror moments.
It helped when he could open a few nights a week for seated audiences. He's even more hopeful now that the bar can open fully. But the sudden announcement left him little time to prepare. The club's bookers are racing to fill the schedule, which could take weeks. Balerna doubts the crowds will return to pre-pandemic levels right away.
You know, just hoping to get back there. And I'll be happy when I get back to the way that it used to be.
It's the first Friday night without COVID restrictions and the 10th anniversary of Hippie Hour, the Midway Cafe's popular Grateful Dead night. As Balerna predicted, the club isn't quite full, but the dance floor is packed. A pink balloon bounces lazily over the heads of the crowd. Hippie Hour regular Jess Gard stands on the street outside and marvels at the events of the past year.
I had a low level of anxiety the entire time. It felt like a weird science fiction movie, like it felt very surreal.
Gard volunteered to work the door when the club partly reopened. She's glad things are getting back to normal.
I've been telling these people they can't dance. These people, my friends, no dancing.
Now they can dance. And Gard says that's important.
So there were a lot of people that this Friday for them was like some people's church on Sunday, you know? It's really very nourishing to the human spirit.
More people spill onto the sidewalk outside the club. Midway booker Heather Timmons is one of the only ones wearing a mask.
I am still like a week from being fully vaccinated, so I don't feel comfortable not wearing one yet.
Timmons is scrambling to manage the flood of emails from bands wanting to play. She's not sure what the next few months will bring.
I think summer's going to be a little weird for shows everywhere, just because a lot of people still aren't comfortable. But we're also getting, like tonight, for example, has exploded and feels pretty normal.
Back inside the club, the band starts to vamp. Frontman Mark Pelletier addresses the crowd.
Lovely little happy family that we built here. And, just so nice that we get to do it all again. Although, I did kind of like the plexiglass a little bit.
The band cranks up and the crowd starts to move. It almost feels like the way it used to be. For Here and Now, I'm Amelia Mason.
And that is the sound of live music on Here and Now.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
We could be looking at a coronavirus surge in our country this fall. That's according to Scott Gottlieb, the former head of the Food and Drug Administration. He believes the highly contagious Delta variant could cut into the nation's progress if only 75% of eligible people are vaccinated. Let's break this down with Dr. Lena Nguyen, who teaches public health at George Washington University. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tanya. Great to join you again.
Yes. So let's start in the South, where cases are climbing. Missouri had a 72% increase in the last 14 days. Arkansas had a 52% climb, and it's happening in other places as well. Oklahoma stands out with a 47% increase. What do these surges tell you?
I think at this point in the pandemic in the U.S., we need to be looking at the numbers not only as where we are as a country, but where we are by region and even by community. Because it could well be that we as a country are doing pretty well. The numbers are going down and we are past the worst of the pandemic. But there are certainly areas of the country that could still be undergoing surges because they don't have enough vaccination and enough immunity in their particular areas. We are going to be seeing this going into the summer, but I really worry about what's going to happen in the fall and in the winter. This COVID-19 is a winter respiratory virus. We also know that people are going to be going indoors at some point when it gets colder. And I really worry about those areas that don't have high vaccination rates. By the way, those areas also coincide in many cases with areas with underfunded public health systems. So I hope that we'll be attentive to these issues. We'll keep up testing, contact tracing, these other core public health measures. But most importantly, we really need to get people vaccinated because this pandemic is not over.
Can you explain the concerns about this Delta variant?
Yes. Yeah, so this Delta variant that originated in India is more contagious, which is very concerning because the Alpha variant, the B117 originating from the UK, was already very contagious, was more contagious than the wild type strain. But this Delta variant is 60% more contagious than the Alpha variant. So we've seen what happened in the UK, that the Delta has crowded out this very contagious Alpha variant. And the Delta variant is now 99% of the variants in the UK. We're seeing this now occurring. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't mean to cut you off, but I just have a moment, 1 minute literally with you. And I want to know what this means for vaccinated listeners who are worried about this variant. Can they do all the things they had planned this summer?
If you are fully vaccinated, you are well protected from the Delta variant. That said, if you're only partially vaccinated, if you only got one dose of the vaccine, you are not protected. The studies are showing that you're probably only about 33% protected from the Delta variant. So make sure you get your second dose. And of course, if you are not yet vaccinated, know that you are still at risk. So get vaccinated if you can. But if you are unable to be vaccinated because you are a child under the age of 12, or if you otherwise are immunocompromised, you need to keep on these social distancing measures, keep on wearing masks when indoors, because you are still very much at risk. The pandemic is certainly not over for you if you are not vaccinated.
Tricky for parents who are vaccinated and have kids under 12. Thank you for this. This is Dr. Lena Nguyen, an emergency physician and professor of public health at George Washington University. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
A factory in Sweden is producing the first batches of steel made without fossil fuel. And just last week, the Swedish carmaker Volvo said it's planning to make new cars with it. Green steel is a big deal because right now the global steel industry is one of the largest emitters of greenhouse gases that cause climate change. Mark Peplow is a science journalist. He wrote about it for Chemical and Engineering News. Mark, good to speak with you.
Good to speak to you too.
And just how much pollution does steelmaking cause around the globe?
A lot. Steelmakers generate over 3 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. That makes up somewhere between about 7 and 9% of all human-made greenhouse gas emissions. And that's according to the industry's own body, the World Steel Association. Essentially, no other industrial material has a greater climate impact.
Hmm. Can you explain why? What is it about the process that makes it so carbon intensive?
Well, it's because carbon plays a vital role at pretty much every stage of steelmaking. You dig up iron ore, you pour in coke, which is like a dense processed form of coal, and limestone, blast of hot air, 2,000 degrees temperature, and what you get out at the end is a form of crude iron called pig iron. And then the second stage of steelmaking, you put that pig iron through another furnace, a basic oxygen furnace, where you adjust the content of carbon and other elements in the mix until you get it just right, and that is steel. You're putting in a lot of carbon, you're removing oxygen, and what you emit is carbon dioxide, warming our planet.
Interesting. So that's the way we've been making steel for ages, right? But there are other alternatives.
Yeah, that's right.
There's technology that's coming out. Swedish steel officials have built a wind-powered steel plant that replaces that blast furnace process you were talking about and uses hydrogen instead of that coal. Yeah. How does that technology work?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's based on a commercial technology that's already operating, which there's more than 100 iron-making furnaces that don't use coke, Instead, they use natural gas. Like I said, there's about 100 of those plants already operating commercially. The beauty of it is that rather than using natural gas, you can then shift over to using all hydrogen. You mentioned the project in Sweden called Hybrit. They're doing that process. They're using hydrogen to turn iron ore into iron metal. But they're making that hydrogen using wind-powered electrolyzers. So that's why it's potentially such a clean process, because you're using a renewable power to make what people call green hydrogen. And then that's the ingredient that you use to make green steel.
It seems like a lot of the research to develop this green steel, for lack of a better term, is happening there in Europe. Why is that?
So there's a lot of reasons, really. One, there's been quite a lot of sort of government funding for these sorts of projects. So Hybrit is a kind of, it gets funding from a mixture of industry investment and public funding and some equity funding as well. So that's one thing. The money's there for it. The second thing is, why is the money there for it? Well, it's in part because the European Union emissions trading system. So this is what's called a cap and trade system. And it's a way of setting ever tightening regulatory limits on how much industry can emit CO2. If an industry is able to avoid emitting very much CO2, it may have some spare carbon emission allowances, and it can sell those to other industries who may not be doing so well at reducing their CO2 emissions, so they can buy those. So that means ultimately that you put a price on carbon emissions, and the price of carbon emissions is going up and up and up. It's absolutely soared over the past year. And this is because the EU is further strengthening its commitments to reduce CO2 emissions.
I see. So what you're saying is it has this revenue that it can generate, which means that it would sort of offset the cost of this new technology and bring it down to something manageable.
That's one side of the coin, yeah. And the flip side is that if the industry doesn't adapt and green its technology, it's going to suffer ever greater financial penalties as the regulations get tighter and tighter. Mm-hmm. And I think that the industry, certainly in Europe, has seen the writing on the wall and is getting ready to shift its production over. Hybrid isn't the only example here. It's probably the one that's furthest ahead and that's kind of most serious about doing this in the short term. But many other steelmakers across Europe are investing in similar sorts of technologies. There are actually a range of different ways of achieving this. But they're investing in that so that they are ready to switch over the next 10 to 20 years.
So that's Europe, but there's the rest of the world. China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, and it produces half of the world's steel. You've also got the United States, which emits the second highest amount of greenhouse gases. What are the prospects for that kind of technology in those places?
Well, China is a big unknown. Like you said, it produces half the world's steel. The government is planning a 30% cut in steelmaking emissions by 2030, but nobody's seen a roadmap for that. So there's a big question mark about how they're going to do that. At the moment, the world's biggest steel-making company is, or one of the world's biggest steel-making companies is China, Baowu Steel. They are putting a lot of money into a technology called carbon capture, so that you run your plants, you're in your old plants just like normal, but you try and stop the CO2 coming out of them from entering the atmosphere. Instead, you capture it using various chemical technologies and maybe effectively bury it underground. A lot of people that I've spoken to think that this is kind of like a band-aid, really, that's ultimately not going to be commercially competitive. In the United States, we're also seeing some activity. It tends to be more startup companies that are taking really innovative approaches, actually, in U.S. steelmaking. There's one example which I really like called Boston Metal, which doesn't use hydrogen at all. Instead, it takes renewable electricity and uses that directly to turn iron ore into actually a form of crude steel. And they're at the stage where they have a pilot reactor running that's, you know, it's about 2 meters wide, I think, something like that. But they're planning the next step up. There are similar sort of electrical processes also being developed in parallel in Europe as well.
So these techniques, they're intriguing. But, you know, I think the thing is we've been making steel more or less the same way for so many years, generations, hundreds of years, right? I mean, even more than that. Mm. How tough will it be to completely revamp the system?
Well, I mean, the industry is an absolute leviathan. The infrastructure that it uses, you know, you build a blast furnace, you expect it to last maybe up to 40 years. So companies are simply not just going to switch those off. So existing technologies are going to be with us for quite a while yet. It's been estimated it will take hundreds of billions of dollars of investment to actually change the technology over to something cleaner and more renewable, more sustainable. But all that said, there have been revolutions in steelmaking before. So if the financial circumstances are right, that really can change the way that an industry makes a material like steel in a couple of decades.
Mark Peplow is a science journalist who wrote about green steel for Chemical and Engineering News. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And while we're talking about technology, next month, Amazon's billionaire boss, Jeff Bezos, plans to fly to space in his new reusable rocket. Since he announced the mission, tens of thousands of people here on Earth have signed a petition with a pretty clear message. Don't come back, Jeff. The petition bluntly says billionaires should not exist on Earth or in space, but should they decide the latter, they should stay there. Billionaire Elon Musk's company is making trips into space. Richard Branson is planning a journey of his own. The Bezos rocket is expected to reach space in just 11 minutes. And if you'd like to join him, one seat is up for auction at $28 million. We presume the petition was written tongue-in-cheek, and for the record, we hope everyone makes the journey safely.
And if you're trying to buy a house right now, you already know it is not easy. For years, houses have been selling for tens of thousands of dollars above asking price, with bidding wars and people putting down all cash offers. And the pandemic has made things far worse in many areas. This is also up against a deepening pain point. The Association of Realtors reports that construction on new homes has fallen short over the last two decades by 5.5 million units. So why aren't more homes being built? Derek Thompson says local governments and communities are partly to blame. And Derek's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us on Mondays from Washington. Hi, Derek.
Hey, good to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you. So here in California, like many areas, we've been dealing with a housing crunch like this for years. Can you lay out what's been happening nationwide, how the pandemic has made things worse?
Yeah, I think some of the biggest problems facing this country, racial inequality, political polarization, declines in innovation, millennial angst, a lot of it can be tied back to the scarcity of housing. And that scarcity has several reasons, but a lot of it comes down to this. We can build houses. We have the technology, but we haven't had the will. And we haven't had the will for much of the last decade. The last decade was the worst decade for housing construction in 60 years. And the reason is largely because states, cities, and neighborhoods have made it too hard to build. We have too many rules designed to prevent new construction of homes rather than encourage the new construction of homes for a growing country.
Yeah, anti-development in communities, NIMBYism, as we often call it. Mm-hmm. We know that is a major problem. Can you give us an example of how all of this is playing out with these latest trends?
Sure, I'll give you a few. There's a couple levels here. So let's start small and work our way up. At the neighborhood level, you have throughout the country, but notably in rich coastal areas, this extreme aversion to new housing projects that might dilute the value of the homes that are already owned. This attitude sometimes goes by the name, as you said, NIMBY, not in my backyard. That's, for example, residents saying, you know, I want to block construction of this new condo because I want to preserve neighborhood character. So one level up from that, the neighborhood, you have local policies. So, for example, I live in Washington, D.C. There is a height ceiling in Washington, D.C. that says you can't build buildings that are higher than this level. Famously in California, you have the great prevalence of single-family zoning, which essentially says that only detached single-family homes can be built in certain areas, that rules out apartment buildings. And then finally, one level up from the local policy, the city policy, you have state policies, like some environmental regulations that have emerged in the last few decades. And I think while a lot of these environmental regulations are very well-meaning and they might accomplish some important ends, they've made it really, really hard for new constructions to get underway. So at the local level, at the neighborhood level, at the city, at the state level, you have sort of these, it's like a Russian nesting doll of NIMBYism, which makes it really hard to say, ah, if we just change this one thing, we can fix the whole problem. It really is this nested challenge.
But Derek, you do see how these sometimes governmental solutions to build density can run up against the desire that people have to live in quieter communities with less traffic and those types of things.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is another reason why I think this is a hard problem to solve. You know, by law and by custom, the U.S. has encouraged people to buy and cherish their houses, treat their houses as investment vehicles. But by doing that, by asking Americans to see their homes as a precious source of their wealth and their intergenerational wealth, those laws essentially activate, I think, a kind of scarcity mindset. And so is the seeds of NIMBYism, right? People say, I own this property. It's a huge part of I put a huge part of my income into it. It's a huge part of my wealth. I don't want to dilute my equity with new housing construction that, oh, by the way, is also going to be really loud and dusty and annoying. It's going to, you know, make it less enjoyable to walk through the community. So I understand where a lot of this aversion to new construction comes from. But what happens is if you scale all these individual decisions to say, oh, don't build here, don't build here, don't build here, what ends up happening? Well, you have a situation like California, where there is a housing shortage of several million homes. Homelessness is rampant. People are moving out of the state at a faster rate than any time in recorded history. So you scale up these individual examples of reasonableness and you get the kind of crisis that California in particular is facing.
Derek, we can't end on this. I mean, do you see at all, I only have about 30 seconds with you, this worsening in the pandemic leading to maybe new urgency for new solutions?
Well, the emergent solution is that if housing isn't going to be built in San Francisco or LA or Boston, then people will leave, right? They will leave and they will move to the places where housing is more ample and more affordable, like Texas or North Carolina or Arizona or Idaho. That's already happening. You are already seeing this migration from the coasts, especially from the Northeast and from California, to these cities in the Inner West and in the Sun Belt. That's going to continue, and it's going to reshape the demographics of America and the politics of America in ways that we've talked about here. That is going to be the solution. If you don't build the houses where people live, they will simply move somewhere else.
Derek Thompson, staff writer with The Atlantic, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.